Hard work beats talent when talent doesn't work hard. That's why when it comes to hard work, nothing works harder than a Chevy Silverado. No wonder Chevy Silverado is the official truck partner of the Chicago Bears. Check out a new Silverado at ChevyDriveChicago.com.
A few weeks ago, my friend Christopher Jacobs, who is among the most talented photographers in the world, we met for drinks at the Billy Goat, and he said, "Oh, dude, you've got to read this book." And he put a book in my hand. Not the first time someone's put a book in my hand. It was called Once We Were Brothers. And Chris said, "You just read the first page and you won't stop reading." And it was true. I am so pleased to have the author of this book, Once We Were Brothers, and the author of three books, four on the way, Ronald Balson, who is a lawyer. But I think of you, Ron, as a novelist. Do you think of yourself as a novelist now?
Well, I'm moving.
I'm sure your check is still coming from the law firm, but
thankfully it does. And,
yeah, stop
and I
being
think
a
I'm
writer.
Moving in that direction, older I get.
What is the seed? You came to this, you came to the arduous chore of writing novels relatively late in life. How old were you when you got the idea for Once We Were Brothers?
Once We Were Brothers. I've always wanted to write a novel, you know, and I've been a lawyer here for 43 years in Chicago, and always wanted to do it. And I actually started what became my second book, Saving Sophie, about 15 years ago, and I started writing it, and I wrote about 150 pages of it, and it wasn't very good, and I threw it away. And then I went to Poland on a case in the mid-2000s. The witnesses were in Poland. The case was here in Cook County.
Yeah.
But the witnesses and the government officials and the documents, everything was in Poland. And I had to go there and take testimony and do my investigative work. And I was there a lot. And walking around Poland, and you can call it inspiration, or I got the idea that I wanted to write a story about that.
Well, walking around Poland, for those people who have not been there or been to Germany or been to some other countries in Europe, the Holocaust is, in a sense, alive there. There are plaques. There are statues. You sense it in a way that you will never sense it in the United States unless you go to the Illinois Holocaust Museum. Am I right about that?
You can't turn a corner in Warsaw that you don't see some memorial, some evidence of the fact. I remember one night we were walking, going out to dinner down Restaurant Row, and I passed this brick building, and there were holes in the wall and a plaque over the hole saying, "Here the Nazis gunned down 25 people in 1942. And, I mean, the scars of World War II are everywhere.
And that affected you, didn't it?
It did. It did affect me. And I, you know, I guess that's where I got the motivation to write a story about an ordinary family, I think one like mine, and what they must have endured during the occupation.
Did you, before starting to write Once We Were Brothers, did you have a interest, for lack of a better word, in the Holocaust, a connection of any personal kind to the Holocaust?
No connection, but an interest.
Well, good, thank God.
Yeah, no. Yeah, my family, we're all immigrants. My family came over from Odessa. And Ukraine area, which was then Russia, at the turn of the century.
Good.
In the 1890s. And so I didn't have any connection family-wise to the Holocaust. But I've always been interested in it and in history.
Well, the interesting thing about it is what Ron Balson writes are historical novels. And in order to do so as compellingly and effectively and powerfully as he does, you need to know the history. You cannot just take a break in the middle of the book and say, "Hitler came to power and blah, 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 blah." It has to be woven into the story. We'll take a short commercial break, and he's going to be here for the whole hour, so we'll get to a lot of this stuff. Once We Were Brothers is the book I would tell you to buy immediately. You can wait till September for Carolina's Twins, which is, I think, an even stronger book. It, too, is Holocaust-related. So we'll take a little break, and then Ron and I are going to be here for the whole hour. He's here with his lovely wife, Monica, and with the aforementioned Christopher Jacobs, who is the reason all of this is happening. Welcome back to After Hours with me, Rick Hogan, and my guest, novelist Ron Balson. He is a lawyer, too, but he's really making a career as a novelist. He went to Poland on a case. Do you win that case?
It's settled. Okay, almost all civil cases settle.
Well, but the trip to Poland inspired him to create a very compelling story of the story starts in contemporary Chicago and a scene at the Lyric Opera where one man pulls a gun on another man, and that sets off this tale that goes all the way back to when the old man with the gun and the rich Chicago patron of the Lyric Opera were little boys in a small town in Poland and what happened to them there. Being in Poland and seeing the scars of the Holocaust doesn't necessarily lead to the creation of two compelling characters. How did you start the writing before you started the deeper research, Ron? I'm fascinated by that.
No, I really needed to pick a location and then get my information on that. And that's the first thing I do. I knew I wanted to write about two brothers, or two people who were like brothers.
Yes.
And then one wouldn't go their separate ways during the war. And I had a timeline, a sketchy timeline of what I wanted to say in the book. But the first thing I had to do was to choose a location. And I chose the town of Samosh, which is in southeastern Poland.
Had you visited that town in your travels? Had you ever seen it before?
Not then, no. Huh. But it is a town not only important and representative of what small towns were in Poland. You know, there were so many small towns that were 25 to 30,000 people,
right,
multicultural,
right.
Maybe 40% sure. Jewish, 30% sure. Jewish. And Samosh was one of them, but it was very important. It was to be, the Nazis were going to make Samosh the capital of the new Poland.
Of the new Poland, yeah, right,
the
right,
central
right.
Government, they call it.
Yeah.
And they were going to change the name to Himmlerstadt.
Charming.
Yeah, delightful.
Charming.
And but one of the reasons I picked it in addition to those was because there's a wealth of information, not just in the museums and in books. There are books about it. But there are memoirs, diaries, photos, letters.
That you could draw upon to give it color and texture then, right?
You could do that, and you could also confirm. I mean, that's fact-checking, you know, one
sure.
source against another.
Well, the other thing, I mean, the setting in Chicago is you do know Chicago, even though you live in the lovely north suburb that will go unnamed. You have the protagonist of the book, Ben Stone, is worked his entire life as a starter at the, for those of you who grew up playing golf in Chicago, still, I call it Waveland, it's now called the Merovitz Golf Course on the lakefront. Your sense of Chicago is really good, and your sense of the ritzy North Shore, Winnetka, where the other person lives, is really good. Are these people at all based on clients?
No.
Friends?
No. You know, people
I know
ask
the lawyer
me a lot.
Client privilege, yeah, yeah. 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 You're not going to break that.
People ask me a lot, who did I'm you sure. pattern this character
sure,
after?
Well, sure.
I really didn't. I mean,
yeah.
I patterned it after a type. And
right.
So I wanted, obviously, the two brothers, I wanted to contrast them their whole lives.
Mm-hmm.
And so on the one hand, you have a guy who works for the park district. He's
right.
a starter at the golf course, just an ordinary guy living in a one-bedroom apartment.
On Bittersweet.
On Bittersweet,
my
right.
memory is still here. That's pretty
yeah,
good. That's pretty good.
And then the other guy, of course, is a
billionaire.
Billionaire
mogul.
Winnetka,
and he...
Gated house.
And he has given money to every charitable organization in Chicago.
Right, right.
He's a benefactor, but there are dark sides to this whole thing. You also have, a lawyer in both of the books, in Once We Were Brothers and Carolina's Twins, an Irish Catholic lawyer. On purpose?
Well, the Liam Taggart is Irish.
He's got
Catholic.
Private eye, yeah.
Yeah, he's the private eye. Catherine Lockhart, I don't know that she's Irish, but she's certainly Catholic.
She's not Jewish, I'll tell you that
definitely
much.
Not
tell you
she's
that
a
much.
Roman Catholic. And, you know, it's funny when you start writing things. I knew I wanted a lawyer, and I knew that I wanted somebody who wasn't Jewish so they could kind of be a sounding board so I could get all the factual
well,
details
and also,
out.
It's very, very, very effective in both of these books in that, you know, Catherine and Liam are not, they don't know anything basically about the Holocaust. Like most people of their age, which I take to be around 30-ish kind of, right?
Yeah, I would say late 30s.
Yeah, but they don't know, which gives you the ability, I think, in the conversation, and it's mostly through conversation. These books are not like history lessons. The history is imbued in the stories of the protagonist, right?
Well, I think that's the value in historical
fiction. No question.
You know,
no question.
You can read a history book, and I've been told this by people that have read the book, and you can read a history book, and it's detailed. You can read The Rise and Fall of the Third Reich, and it'll have everything you want to know. But at the end of the book, and you put it down, and sometimes it doesn't stick with you.
Yeah.
But if there's a story, and you can manage to write a story where people care about the characters.
Well, that's it. You can hook it on a human being. And that's what, to my mind, the Holocaust ever was, the destruction of 6 million, 7 million, however many it was. There were 6 or 7 million human stories involved in that. And when you read the dry, that's why going to the Illinois Holocaust Museum is a chilling and moving experience, I think, because you get to see faces.
It is moving.
Yeah. And you created these faces. Was it hard to write? I know that, you know, lawyers spend their whole careers, which we may not understand, writing things.
Exactly.
You know, you're a writer as a lawyer,
exactly.
Right?
Exactly.
Yeah.
You write briefs, you write memorandums, you write appeals.
Sure.
But you don't write fiction. Although,
right.
You know, there are judges that
oh, no, I know. I know some lawyers who've written a lot of fiction in court cases, and I'm sure you have, too.
Yeah.
It's not a switch you have to flick. It's such a different kind of writing. It obviously came pretty easily to you because your wife Monica is still here and you didn't punch holes in the wall.
I don't get angry when I write. I really enjoy writing.
I'm not saying angry, I mean frustrated. There's some
mostly I don't.
Wow.
I don't get frustrated.
Yeah.
Sometimes scenes will come slowly, but I have a timeline. I know where I want to go. So I don't really have a writer's block. I might get to an area where I think I'm not telling the scene as interestingly as I could, and
yeah.
Or maybe the language isn't as colorful as it should be.
Did you have, as many writers do, as many fiction writers do, a set routine? You know, Hemingway, hungover or not, would be up at his standing desk every morning for an hour or two. Did you have Scott Turow, famously the other writer lawyer, famously wrote his books on the train ride into the loop?
Yeah, yeah.
Did you have that kind of routine?
I don't. I'm juggling. So I juggle my legal work and with the writing. And some weeks legal work takes more time than I like. And then there are other weeks when legal work is kind of slow and I can get a lot of hours in. And I write well at the office. So,
describe the character who may have been... Describe the character, and you're really good at suspense, too. Ben thinks that this millionaire, billionaire Chicago philanthropist is a kid he grew up with who became something else, who's Ben's parents took him in. He became something else during the war. He certainly became something after the war. Describe this guy.
Well, There are two people to describe.
The present day
Elliot Rosenzweig, I think, is a man in his late 70s, early 80s. I think is well seasoned. He's very, very wealthy. He's managed to amass billions of dollars and paint himself as a great benefactor for the city of Chicago, chummy with the mayor and all.
Sure.
But as a child, he was a waif. He was, you know, his father brought him by because he couldn't support him. He had lost his job as a woodcutter, had nowhere to go, and he knew that Ben's father, back in this is 1930s now, was a kind man and might help him out. And they agreed to take the boy in for a while, and he ended up growing up with Ben together.
They were. I mean, that the title is so meaningful on that level once we were brothers, not in the biological sense, certainly, but certainly in the familial sense. They were closer than some brothers, don't you think?
Well, yeah, sure they were, yeah.
I love the way you answered. Well, yeah, Rick, you idiot. What are you talking about? Well, of course they are. You read the book, you moron. When you finished the book.
Unimaginative answer.
No, I'm not. No, no. It was a great answer. It was an unimaginative question. When you finished the book, you must have been, you know, you couldn't have known anything about the incredibly screwed up world of contemporary publishing. You obviously thought to yourself, and Monica's your first reader, you guys obviously thought to yourself, well, I can get this book published, right?
Of course.
Yeah, of course. We're going to tell you about that after the news, because that's a great story in itself. The books, again, the author is Ronald, more formal title on the, I think, Monica, you call him Ronnie, right? I call him Ron, but his formal name as a novelist is Ronald H. Balson, B-A-L-S-O-N. Go Google it now. This is Rick Kogan, back after 2 weeks off for Hawks games. I don't even remember if they won those or didn't win those, but they played them. If you've been listening, I've been talking to Ron Balson about his novel, Once We Were Brothers. It took him 3 years to write. It is a historical novel hooked on the beginning, the foundation of it is the horrors of the Holocaust and what happened to two young men who were not biological brothers but were closer than biological brothers. They both wind up in Chicago, one as a billionaire philanthropist, the other as a, if you ever know what a starter has to go through at Waveland Golf Course, you will know why this man is a strong man. Because I wanted to play at 9 o'clock. What did you do to me? It's a compelling, compelling book, I think, worthy of film. It also has two charming people, a private eye named Liam and a lawyer who's in some trouble herself. Well, she's had some bad times, too, but she is coming out of them. And they are... It's a good romance. It's a good romance, but everyone winds up falling in love with Ben. You finish this wonderful book. You and your wife say, wow, this is a great book, which it is. Let's go get it published. What was that like?
Well, I learned something. I learned that there's a difference between writing a book and having someone read your book.
Yeah. Or not someone buy your book. You can get people to read it. You can give it to them on the street corner.
I suppose that's true.
they won't pay for it.
I didn't know anything. I mean, I was really kind of naive about all this. I didn't know anything about the publishing industry. I quickly found out that you had to have a literary agent. They're kind of like the gatekeepers. They present the books to the editors at the publishing companies. And so I went about trying to get a literary agent, and I send out my query letters with sample chapters and summaries. And I would get back postcards, dozens and dozens of rejections.
Basically, thanks but no thanks.
We can't use this.
Did you get any?
Doesn't fit our needs.
Did you get any that were encouraging or at all personalized?
You know, I came to believe that these were pre-printed rejection notices, and that if you could go down to Office Max and ask them for a pack of pre-printed rejection notices to take with you back, and then
and say, "Hey, we have a sale on those today."
Yeah, sure, exactly.
You can have them.
So, you know, I mean, it's cold. It's most times every once in a while you get a personal one and might say, "I liked your book, but I really didn't love it."
Ugh,
so, yeah, right.
What a cliche of publishing that is.
Yeah. And So I at the end of the day, I couldn't get it published.
So what did you decide to do?
Well, I decided to be my own publishing company, and I formed my own publishing company, and we got a printer. My son.
When you say we, your son.
My son and I. He's very technologically
savvy.
Yeah, and he formatted it properly. He managed to get it online, so you could buy it online. You could buy it from downloaded from Barnes and Nobles and Amazon, and.
Mm-hmm.
We printed a bunch of copies out, and I put them in my basement.
And it started to sell, though, didn't it?
Not for a while. But it was about 7 or 8 months, and I don't know, maybe we sold 100 copies the whole time. And then all of a sudden, it just 1,000 copies in September 2011. I remember that. 3,000 the next month, 8,000 the next month, and it just...
And this way, you were confounded, weren't you? You're like,
totally.
What is happening here?
I did no marketing or promotion. Totally word of mouth.
Yeah.
I guess you have to ask yourself, how did you read the last book that you read? Because Chris Jacobs told you to read this book.
That's right. That's right. Christopher Jacobs. I'll do every week. I'll do the Christopher Jacobs novel recommendation. Well, because this would have been under my radar. I mean, I didn't get a copy. You don't have a publisher who sends them out to various places. You ever figure out the mystery? It really was just word of mouth, wasn't it?
It was word of mouth. Yeah, totally word of mouth.
But then, in one of the great modern-day publishing stories, you get a call or an inquiry from St. Martin's Press.
Yeah, I'd sold about maybe 125,000 copies by that time.
That's a lot of books!
Yeah, right. And I got a call from St. Martin's. The editor, her aunt had given her the book at Christmas time. And you know, editors and publishing companies, they have a desk full of manuscripts they have to read.
No kidding.
And then deadlines to read them. So she tells her aunt, I can't read this book. I don't have time.
Yeah.
But her aunt says, you have to read it.
And maybe they use the Chris Jacobs line, read this first page and you can't put it down. Maybe that's what she said, too.
I think they're in cahoots.
I think Chris is running American publishing now.
God bless him.
And she did read it, and she was terribly
impressed.
She was
impressed, reading it on a train, and a conductor that she describes as this curmudgeon-y guy who no one likes and doesn't talk to anybody, taps her on the shoulder and says, hey, that's a good book.
Unbelievable.
And she says, how do you know that? And he says, well, I see people read it, so I buy it. It's a good book.
It's the only book I've read in 40 years. Yeah. It's the best book I've ever read. And so St. Martin's tells you, we would like to publish your book. To take it out of the morass of independently published books.
Right.
And they say, do you have another book?
Well, sort of, yeah.
Yeah.
I was working on Saving Sophie at the time.
Yeah.
It wasn't a two-book deal. They bought Once We Were Brothers, and it did really well.
And
they sold it overseas, and it did really well overseas.
And you it's a wonderful, wonderful story, ladies and gentlemen, because it is a wonderful, wonderful book. And it's like, to my mind, it's like, you know, a baby in a forest or something, and someone just hears a little cry and finds the baby, and it turns out to be, you know, Moses or something. You must have been, how many copies has it sold? Do you know, roughly?
Roughly, half a million.
Wow. Do you and Monica sometimes think to yourself, you get up or say to yourselves, holy cow.
Every day.
Yeah.
Every day.
It must have, however, for Sophie, I have yet to read the book about Sophie, but I have read Carolina's Twins, which will be on sale September 6th, this coming September 6th. And I've already, because he'd been so good, invited Ron to come back in September or October and get into details about that story. But having this kind of attention, having this, you've been legitimized by St. Martin's when they call you and they say, hey, we're St. Martin's Press and we want to publish this book. You must feel terribly empowered. Did it change your writing in any ways?
I don't think so. I mean, my writing evolves, I hope. I'm better at sentence structure than I was in the beginning. I think I have.
You're
a better,
fine at sentence structure.
Well, I don't know. I think I have a better sense of how to put paragraphs together and chapters together. There's kind of a secret that I've been told that I didn't realize when I wrote it. But you know, you recognize in my books they're very short chapters.
Yeah.
Chapters are only 3, 4, 5 pages long.
Yeah.
And there may be 80 chapters in a book.
Right.
And it turns out that people like that because they at night they say, oh, I can read one more chapter. I'll read one more chapter.
Yeah. It know? Moves. No, yeah. There's no question about that.
It does tend to move the book.
There's no question about that. Who taught you that?
It's innate.
It's innate. Yeah. It's something.
I fell into that manhole.
Something in your soul. You then started doing, in kind of what they call public relations support of Once We Were Brothers, talks all over the place, right? I mean,
everywhere.
Book from small book groups to libraries to associations to.
Yeah. I spoke to a luncheon of 800 women down in Florida, and I spoke to 300
that was
people
okay with
in
Monica?
Montreal.
That was okay with Monica?
She was there.
Okay. Just checking.
Yeah. I do sometimes.
It's not like taking a hermit out into the public. I mean, you're pretty comfortable speaking in public, aren't you?
I think so. Yeah. I think I am.
Well, how many books have
get
you
get up
sold?
On a stage and speak to 300 people? And I've done it so many times now that.
One thing I want to ask you, because Carolina's Twins is also, I think, even more deeply. Holocaust historical. We got to take a little break, but come back and talk to you about, was there any price to pay for doing that kind of research? I asked, since you were listening, Ron Balson, just before we took that commercial break, if it was not emotionally debilitating, I guess is the right word, to have done so much research about the Holocaust for your first book, Once We Were Brothers. It is also the foundation of the book that comes out in September, Carolina's Twins. It had to be hard, wasn't it, Ron?
It is. Well, you spend time with your characters, and my characters, they're real to me. They're real people.
Yeah.
And I'm living with my characters when I write the story, and I'm trying to fashion what they would be thinking and feeling. And so when you write a book about the Holocaust and it takes you 2-3 years, like it did for Once We Were Brothers. It's a lot of time in a very dark period.
No question.
And so I did not. My second book was not a Holocaust book. It was
Saving Sophie.
It was Saving Sophie, and Saving Sophie is a contemporary drama that takes place in Chicago and Honolulu and in the West Bank of Israel. And so, that's a totally different story.
Right.
Catherine and Liam are in it.
But it was a relief of some. Of some kind to just pull yourself away from, these sort of nightmarish. It was nightmarish research you had to do too, but then in Carolina's Twins, you brought yourself back to it. You felt emotionally healthy enough to do it, emotionally strong enough.
I was ready. I was ready to do it.
Yeah.
It's based on a true story. And
oh, I know.
I met this woman during my Once We Were Brothers book tour, and I had lunch with her, and I just thought she was the most magnificent woman I've ever met, and her story was incredible. And I asked her, can I write your story? And nonchalantly, she said, sure, of course. But of course, right at that time, I was in the middle of Saving Sophie, and I had to wait till I was finished.
Yeah.
But
she inspired that story in the story. I'm not going to get into it today. The book doesn't come out till September, and you are already booked to come back in September or October to talk about Carolina's Twins. You've been practicing law for a long time. Are you ready to give that up and devote yourself fully?
I don't think so.
You like law.
Well, yeah. I mean, I'm comfortable doing it. I've done it for 43 years.
Yeah.
I think that, I'm certainly slimming down my practice, and I'm far more selective about what I want to do and what I don't want to do. And if I don't want to do a case, I don't have to do it, and that's nice. And
are the other lawyers in your firm, are they jealous of you? Are they jealous?
Oh, they're supportive. They're wonderful.
Oh, that's fantastic.
Yeah, they're wonderful.
You haven't heard from Scott. To Roe at all.
No, have I haven't heard from him.
Yeah, I know Scott pretty well. He's a wonderful guy. He's a very good writer, too, and vastly different.
Excellent
writer. He's a great writer, but vastly different kinds of things. I'd love to get him in here, too, when you come back in the fall and just say, hey, you guys, you're not going to teach me to be a lawyer, of course, but you could teach me to write books in my spare time.
Well, he's such an incredibly successful writer and
deservedly so.
Writer.
Sure, and he's a great lawyer too. I mean, but he can't pull away from the law either. I mean, Scott could you know, sit in a hammock for the rest of his life and
dictate
books to a tribe of stenographers or something. You're working on your fourth now, even as we speak and even as we await the publication of Carolina's Twins. What's that about? Can you tell
the
listeners?
I can't write two Holocaust books in a row.
Yeah.
I do have a fifth way on the back shelf that I'm talking to St. Martin's about now.
That's about a globe-trotting, world-famous photographer who gives novels to people all over the world.
I can't give that away.
What?
I can't give that away. No, the book I'm working on now is about Northern Ireland.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah.
You're doing a lot of research about it?
Sure am.
Yeah. It must be fascinating, too.
It is fascinating. It is fascinating to learn all about. You know, we all knew that there was trouble. We knew about the IRA. We knew about the Ulster Constabulary. We knew that there were problems during what they call the Troubles in Northern Ireland and in Belfast. But I didn't really know that much about it.
See, I'll tell you something. I'm having on the next hour a guy named Max Grinnell who does tours of historical things in Chicago, and he and I always talk, and you and I talk. We don't know anything because history is not taught in any kind of palpable way anymore, I think, in schools. I mean, if you went and asked a sixth grader in Chicago what the Holocaust was, even though the Holocaust is mandated to be taught in public schools, you wouldn't have a clue because we live in such a fat. You look it up on Wikipedia, you know what I mean? And I think these books are of such deep value because you put a human face on what I will ever consider the great horror of the 20th century. And I don't blame you for not being able to write them back to back. Who's your favorite author? Anybody inspire you as a novelist?
I don't know. People ask me that, and it's kind of hard. I mean, to pick one author over another.
Pick one who's dead. Pick like Hemingway or something. I'm not saying.
I tell you what, I'm a big fan of Joan Didion.
Oh, God, I love you,
I
Ron.
Love her writing.
Well, she's one of a kind.
One of a kind.
She is one of a kind.
Yeah.
Do you read newspapers?
Sure I do.
Okay.
Every day.
Thank God. Well, you're one of the rare. Yeah, you're one of the rare cases. If you had any, before I let you go, and you and Monica can drive home, there ain't been any movie nibbles about these because there's something very, very cinematic.
There's an option agreement.
Oh, good.
That's outstanding on.
And you did the legal work on that yourself because of these Hollywood.
No, I did not. I don't have a fool for a client, right?
Yeah, good for you.
So we're hopeful. We're hopeful on Once We Were Brothers.
Well, you and I, the next time we see each other, we can cast the
thing. It's a deal.
The thing. Ron, it's a pleasure to know you and the great photographer Christopher Jacobs, who, as good a photographer as he may be an even better literary critic. He gives me the book, goes, read the first page. And that's what I did. And now I'm hooked. I have read Once We Were Brothers. I have read the upcoming Carolina's Twins. I'm moving on to Saving Sophie and eagerly awaiting the fourth and fifth novels. And you do write by your wife in these books. You dedicate them to her and say how important Monica is in your writing life.
Oh, that's true. Yeah.
You're the best. You're the best, and these are really great books.